This is David Rovix, and you are tuned to 3CR, 8:55 a.m., Melbourne, Australia. Step three is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do, and everything can change.
You're listening to the Climate Action Show on the Community Broadcast Network. We acknowledge and pay respect to the people of the Woiwurrung and Boiwurrung language groups of the Eastern Kulin Nations on whose unceded lands the 3CR studios stand, respectfully acknowledging their ancestors and elders, past, present and emerging. We also acknowledge the traditional custodians and their ancestors of the lands and waters across Australia, where our broadcast reaches. Thank you for tuning into the Climate Action Show on the Community Broadcast Network tonight. You'll be joined by me tonight, Bella, and we'll be focusing on the ongoing war in the Middle East and how this is relating back to our ongoing climate crisis. Just before I begin, I'd like to acknowledge the severe health and human rights disaster in the Middle East, and my heart goes out to anyone and everyone affected. And if there's a topic that you feel quite strongly over or emotionally over, potentially this might not be the best episode for you. As of last Wednesday, the 8th of April, there was a two-week ceasefire agreement that had been agreed upon by Iran, Israel, and the United States of America to negotiate and resolve the current conflict in the Middle East. However, at this point in time, the ceasefire agreement is quite shaky. There has been no agreement to stop the war as of the most recent information put out, and the Strait of Hormuz is still closed, and as of today may potentially be further closed off by the United States Navy. The effects of this have been abundantly felt by all Australians when it comes to oil and fuel energy in terms of availability and pricing, and will no doubt continue to become clearer and clearer, especially for those in rural communities who rely on fuel and diesel in particular, such as the agricultural farming industry, as well as very isolated and rural First Nations communities. The fuel crisis created by the war in the Middle East has pulled back the curtains on Australia's massive, yet unstable reliance on fossil fuels, as many sectors and industries in our society are threatened, including essential health, agriculture, transportation, energy, and many more. To get a better understanding on Australia's unreliable fossil fuel dependency, we'll be hearing from the Doctors for the Environment Australia's after-hours webinar, Quitting Our Oil Dependency, discussing the effects the fuel crisis is having in agricultural, medical and renewable energy sectors. The webinar is hosted by Dr. Kate Wiley, who's the Executive Director of DEA, or Doctors for the Environment Australia. And she'll be joined by guest Peter Holding from Farmers for Climate Action, Dr. Kim Humphrey, who is also part of DEA, and Frances Veerboom from Rewiring Australia. And then together they explore the opportunity we have been presented with from this exposition to move to more reliable, cleaner, renewable energy here in Australia. And just a bit about DEA, it's a non-for-profit advocacy organisation that is the leading medical voice for the climate crisis. Before we get to that, though, one of our Climate Action Show members, Antimony, ran into a few local activists outside of MP Sarah Whitty's office this last Friday, who were protesting Labor's plan for coal and gas expansions. So we'll hear a bit of that first. So stay tuned for what's to come in the show. You're listening to the Climate Action Show on the Community Broadcast Network here with Bella tonight. And stay tuned for all that is to come.
I was riding my bicycle down Johnson Street in Fitzroy on Friday afternoon when I came across a group of citizens doing an activism outside Sarah Whitty's office. So I decided to stop and see what they're about. And I actually ended up having a really nice chat with them in which they told me who they were, what they were doing, and all about Labor's new plans for coal and gas expansion. And full disclosure, they actually did end up buying me a coffee and a cake during this conversation, but I didn't know about this until afterwards when I went and tried to pay, as if there weren't enough reasons to become a climate activist.
This is a bunch of people who are outside the office of Sarah Whitty, who's the MP in this area, federal MP, and we're really not happy about how the Labor government is approving lots and lots more coal mines and gas fields and pretty well ignoring the climate crisis in that regard. So we're here and we're getting people to toot on the street and we're making a lot of noise so that, and we're doing this every Friday so that Sarah Whitty MP can't forget that we're upset about climate and Labor's policy towards fossil fuels.
Right, and how many toots are you getting?
Loads. We're getting loads of toots.
Yeah.
You're getting more toots now these days, or has it been pretty consistent?
Oh, pretty consistent, yeah. Actually, we get, there's a lot of support out there in the community. People just really hate the idea of sailing through approving new coal, gas, while we're really in a climate emergency. You know, it's just madness. So, yeah, people are really supportive of the idea of protesting that, yeah. This action's been going probably nearly 6 months, maybe. Mm. Yeah, around about that. Yeah, so, yeah.
And have you had a response from Sarah Whitty's office?
Yes, we've actually spoken to Sarah a number of times. And I think on the one hand, she's, you know, probably a bit embarrassed that we're here. But on the other hand, it gives her ammunition to take to Parliament and saying that the people in my electorate are not happy, you know, they want change. And that's what we're really trying to get to her, you know.
Can you tell me a little bit about what you're actually doing on the street?
Yeah, we're waving placards that say no new coal and gas, honk for action on climate. Mm-hmm. And we've even got one that says Labor elected by you and serving the fossil fuel industry. So,
perfect. Yeah. So everyone else in the group, how are you finding these weekly actions?
Very positive. I mean, just as politicians will say, people like Sarah Whitty will say that there's a great call on the public purse and it's very difficult to apportion money for different causes. One guy today turned down his window and he yelled at me when I was waving the climate sign. He was saying, what about the cost of living crisis? Well, that's also something that has to be taken into account. But you can't ignore the climate issues that are going on around you. And for this fellow who was driving, just doing his ordinary day work, it was very important of him to think about what was important to him. Well, he's got a job and there's no jobs on a dead planet. So I thought that was something to think of. And all I could say to this fellow as he was driving past slowly, but he gave it to, all I could say to him was, yes, you're right. And when he was looking at my sign about climate, I hope he was thinking that I was right as well.
I've been involved with the Extinction Rebellion for a long time, but I hadn't been to this protest before. But I go to Extinction Rebellion, also have a climate action every Friday morning on the steps of Parliament, which has been going for a couple of years now. And we also have, once a month, on Saturday mornings, we have a women's circle outside the Art Centre, which is fabulous, and that actually coincides with women's circles all around the world.
And how did you find today going out in the street?
Great, because it's such a good team. It gives you hope to work with other people that are on the same wavelength. Yeah, yeah. And I always think it's a bit like Bob Brown says, don't get depressed, get active.
Mm-hmm.
Like, rather than sitting at home getting more and more anxious about what's happening with climate breakdown, to get out on the street and be with like-minded people who are really supportive and great company makes you feel better and gives you hope. Yeah.
Thinking about that hope, I think we help give all those motorists that go past and bip their horns, which there is a lot, and truck drivers, sometimes bus drivers. We even had an ambo, because I think what is the enemy of transitioning to renewables is people feel they can't do anything and it's all too hard and it's all too depressing, and you sort of don't mention it because it's a downer. So this is an upbeat action. People beep, people smile, people give you the thumbs up, people thank you for handing out a leaflet. I was handing out a leaflet today that we made, and we keep updating our leaflets. And I was saying, here's some things we can all do. And the pickup rate was really strong. So after we take our banners down, we retreat to a really nice coffee place, just 100 metres from where we stand, and we have a great coffee and a sort of wind down and a nice time together. So it's not just about being standing in the street and feeling wrung out. It's about coming along. You get a feeling of buoyancy because people like you to be there. You get a few getter jobs, but predominantly you get people that are appreciative of you being here. And you leave with a bit more of a bounce in your step. And you've given a message to the local MP that we really, really, really are not happy about more new fossil fuels being opened. It's one thing giving a few little, well, giving some subsidies for solar and this and that, that's fine, but the amount of new fossil fuels that they're opening up at the same time is so hypocritical. So it's a good thing to do, and the other thing, the reason I'm here, is that it's doable. It is absolutely doable. Yeah, you don't have to put yourself on the line. You know, you come along, do some good, and then just keep on doing it.
Yeah, my name's Mary. I'm part of this group on Fridays, almost every Friday. Yeah, it's good. It makes me feel better in the face of all the stuff that's going on, you know, just to be doing something active, you know, feel much better for it. But it's really important too, because it just drives me mad that, like, Labour just, like, stifles people's concerns about the climate crisis. They actually work really, really hard to try and blanket it over all the time. It's the kind of a gaslighting, you know, because a lot of people realise that we are in a crisis, that things look very bleak unless some really urgent action is taken. But, you know, Labour's attitude the whole time, of course Liberals are a lot worse, but Labour's attitude is, no, it's all right, you know, business as usual is okay. Well, it's not okay. And that's really one of the things that we're trying to say with our banners. Is we have quite a colourful setup. We're only here for an hour, just because we figure it's better to be, like, regular and for the regular people not to get too worn out. So it's fairly short and sweet and really good fun. Sort of, there's other climate vigils too. There's actually a new one happening about the Hall Creek Marubeni mine, because the Marubeni company is proposing to expand the Hale Creek coal mine into koala protected areas. So that's happening on Tuesdays between 12 and 1 in 120 Collins Street at outside Parliament. And there's also an action that takes place in St Kilda outside Josh Byrne's office on a Friday. So yeah, there's different groups as well as the ones that Barb mentioned, the Mother's Rebellion on a Saturday once a month, and the regular Friday vigil. So, yeah, I mean, these things are really worth doing, because it helps to go against this sort of Labour's constant, you know, stifling of... I mean, a lot of people really are concerned about the climate. It's just infuriating to feel that Labour, in spite of actually having a lot of potential support to take really clear and urgent action, they're just sort of... Well, they're not doing it. It drives me mad.
Yeah, my name's Rob. It's the highlight of my week coming down to Sarah Whitty's office. It really is fantastic to see the support of the public. There's obviously a need for an outlet for regular people to voice their disquiet and anger about the lack of action on what is pretty much an existential crisis moment. It's also great to see that not just Extinction Rebellion, but Australian Conservation Foundation and Yarra Climate Action Network are publicising and bringing people to this action as well. So I think it's really heartening to know that we can pull our collective groups together and put pressure on the government rather than just waiting for, you know, one big action every now and then. I think it's really important that the frequency of a weekly action, 12:30 to 1:30, it's not a big ask for a lot of people, but it certainly has an impact on the office of Sarah Whitty. And we've had anecdotal feedback from staff members that it is quite annoying from them. So that gives us a lot of heart And yeah, just from a purely selfish point of view, I really enjoy the idea of creating a bit of indigestion on a Friday lunch for them, and know that we are absolutely red-hot angry about their lack of action on climate action.
And just to finish up, can we reiterate the events that are coming up?
So there's this action in Johnston Street outside Sarah Whitty's office on a Friday, 12:30 to 1:30. There's one in 219 Barclay Street outside Josh Byrne's office on a Friday from 12:30. There's the Friday Vigil for Climate between 8:30 a.m. and midday every Friday outside Parliament House, yeah. There's an action on a Tuesday about the Hale Creek Marubeni mine. So that's on the Tuesdays between 12 and 1 p.m. at 120 Collins Street outside Parliament. And the Mothers' Rebellion, they meet once a month at 11 a.m. at the National Gallery of Victoria, 180 St Kilda Road. But that's really, really nice.
So we have an events page on the Extinction Rebellion website. So it has these events, ausrebellion, or one word, .earth/events. So that's our events page.
Tell all your friends, 3CR, 855 on your dial.
You're listening to the Climate Action Show on the Community Broadcast Network, or as you just heard, 3CR 855 AM.
The Climate Action Team would like to thank Only Just for their financial support of this program. Only Just sources high quality, fair trade goods and gifts from artisans in over 25 developing countries, showcasing partners that use traditional skills and modern designs to create beautiful goods through ethical and sustainable practices. Discover their unique range, onlyjust.com.au, or visit their Eltham store in the Eltham Village Shopping Centre on Main Road. It's Only Just.
They're eyeing off an estate which is in perfectly good condition. It just happens to have bay views and a lot of open space.
Bay Views for All is a new documentary that reveals the human cost of the Victorian government's public housing redevelopment project. The film documents residents of the Barrack Beacon public housing estate as they fight to save their homes and community. Bay Views for All is available for community members, public housing advocates, and organisations to screen, intending to spark conversations, raise funds, and educate audiences on the importance of public housing. To organise a screening, email barrackbeacon@gmail.com. That's BARACBEACON @gmail.com.
Save public housing! Stop the demolition!
A 3CR supporter.
You're listening to the community. You're listening to the Climate Action Show on the Community Broadcast Network, or more specifically on 3CR 855 AM, and you're here with me, Bella, tonight. We just heard from one of our Climate Action Show members, Antimony, who ran into a few local activists outside of MP Sarah Whitty's office this last Friday, who were protesting Labor's plan for coal and gas expansions. The activists are sort of ran by a bunch of different groups who get together, like Extinction Rebellion and Mothers' Rebellion. And if you're interested in getting involved, it's a nice way just to meet like-minded people. And like the people who said who were interviewed, it's a good way just to have a nice and kind of wholesome community to get around. And if you're feeling a bit down about everything that's going on right now, they're very, very lovely people. They love to chat about why they're always out there every Friday, and what they're doing and why it matters. So they're there every Friday, 12:30 to 1:30 p.m. And if you're interested, go and have a chat. I'm sure they'd love to. We're now going to go on to the After Hours webinar held by Doctors for the Environment Australia, which is on quitting our oil dependency here in Australia, as we found out during this ongoing war in the Middle East, this ongoing health and human crisis. Australia has quite a large dependency on global oil exports and fossil fuels, and we're feeling that in every industry at the moment, including agricultural, health, and transportation. So DEA held a bit of a webinar just to discuss a few of the ways that we can turn around our usage of fossil fuels now to a more reliable, cleaner and renewable energy here in Australia that's more substantial and more sustainable. The webinar is held by Dr. Kate Wiley, who's the Executive Director for DEA, and she's joined by guest Peter Holding from Farmers for Climate Action, Dr. Kim Humphrey, also a part of DEA, and Frances Vierboom from Rewiring Australia. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Climate Action Show on 3CR 855 AM or on the Climate Hour on the Community Broadcast Network. And you're here with me tonight, Bella.
So the first thing I just want to acknowledge is that this is actually a very difficult topic, and that the conflict in the Middle East is a health and human rights disaster. And, you know, my heart goes out to all of those that are affected by this tragedy, you know, in the Middle East and across the planet. For us in Australia, it's highlighted how our dependence on oil has left households, communities, hospitals, essential services, you know, the whole of our society basically exposed. And that, you know, we do have renewable resources which perhaps offer a path to a cleaner, healthier and more resilient future. And tonight we're going to have a discussion about that, see where it takes us. As I said, this is a big, difficult topic. I don't expect us to have all the answers to such a massive global problem, but at least we're going to open up and have a bit of a discussion. So let's meet our panel. So my first, I'll start with you, please, Peter. Hello. Could you just say briefly, what are the top line things that you're worrying about this week as we see petrol and diesel supplies threatened in Australia?
Ah, well, good evening. And yeah, the main thing I'm concerned about is our farmer members planting, getting crops in or getting crops harvested. Requires an enormous amount of diesel, and it requires an enormous amount of urea. And I was working on the costings, and it costs about $260 of urea to grow a ton of canola, about half that for wheat, and that makes it almost unviable to grow when you consider all the other costs that you've got to add in to put a crop in. So I'm very concerned about where we're headed with cropping this week.
I think that probably has implications for Kim's answer to the same question. Hello, Kim. What's the top line things that you're worrying about with this global instability?
Yeah, thanks, Kate, and thanks, Peter. So obviously I come at this from a health perspective. So my background is both as an emergency medicine physician and I work in public health as well. It's all very concerning, as Kate has sort of outlined at the top there. I guess the top three things that I'm most concerned about this week, number one is the continuity of essential health services. So we know that our health service really across Australia is still mostly fuel dependent. That's been part of health that's particularly hard to decarbonise. Our ambulances, patient transport, home care visits, pathology, medicine supply chains all rely almost entirely on petrol and diesel, and even really short disruptions to those can turn into patient safety issues really quickly as well, not to mention the costs that are being borne if you can't afford to get petrol. So that's a big one. Second is the immediate impact on people who are at risk. So we're thinking about groups like older Australians, people with chronic disease or disability, and those in rural and regional areas in particular are really exposed to what we're facing at the moment. Many of them already face barriers to getting good healthcare, and fuel shortages just make access so much harder as well. And then the last part, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the community stress and anxiety, all of the uncertainty around not only the world situation, but can I get petrol? Can I get to work? Can I access healthcare? Incredibly stressful. And the uncertainty itself becomes a health issue then, particularly those families who are already struggling as well. So all of this is not just energy or transport. It's an immediate public health risk that can escalate very quickly if we don't manage this well.
Thank you, Kim. And I feel like, you know, I'm sure Peter's communities would be feeling that sort of mental health distress that you mentioned there at the end. What about you, Frances? You know, what are the top line things you're worrying about this week as we see our petrol and diesel supplies threatened?
Yeah, it's great to join this webinar on an important topic, Kate. I think the figure that stood out to me that I've seen this week is that Australia uses about it's 7.7 barrels, or which is 1,200 litres of diesel per person to keep our economy going per year. And that's by far the biggest usage in the developed world per person. And the next closest oil importer is Germany, that is nearly half of that. So, you know, two, three, and four are the US, Canada, and Saudi Arabia behind us. So we're an economy and a country that's incredibly dependent on importing that fuel source. It actually shocked me to learn that we're top of that league table, and so much of our mining and agriculture is going to be hit really hard, and it's such a big job to actually turn over our dependence on that.
So many far-reaching problems, isn't it? And you know, like, so coming, let's come back to you, Kim, and get you to pick up on the health stuff on that. You know, what can you expand a bit on your introduction? Like, what other health issues do you see? You know, considering also obviously mainly health practitioners in the room, and sort of flow on, please.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess with something like this, the health impacts tend to show up much faster than we expect they will. We kind of don't think about this as a health crisis, although this is what is happening, is a health crisis. So the most immediate issue, as I outlined, is health system functionality. So ambulance services, logistics, etc., all of these things, and particularly in regional and remote areas, these are already discussions that are happening about how can we support our regional and remote communities, including our Aboriginal communities, because they are almost entirely reliant on diesel, not just to drive around, but for things like generators as well. And even very minor disruptions can increase response times and really force services to start thinking about who gets treated or who gets care first. And that's an incredibly scary thing, I think, in, you know, the first world context that we live in as well. Closely linked to that is continuity of treatment. So the fact that many medications and medical supplies are on very tight delivery schedules. And if there's even a small interruption or delay, that significantly affects people who have medical conditions that really rely on sort of those time critical interventions. So we're thinking about people with diabetes, respiratory disease, people who are on dialysis. Anything with a condition where a missed dose or a delayed treatment can lead to really rapid consequences. So any of you in the room, and I know it's many of you who are health professionals, can probably think of an example where if a patient doesn't get a particular treatment within a particular time frame, it's a big problem. So that's the kind of thing that we'll see. Other rural and regional impacts. So people who live in the regions, as I sort of referred to before, they already travel really long distances often for appointments and treatment. When fuel is scarce and expensive, like it is at the moment, then it's a choice. You go, I can't afford to do that. I can't. I have to ration my trips. I'm not going to go and, you know, seek my appointment this week, which perhaps is part of preventive healthcare. So it may not be an emergency, but if you don't attend those appointments, then health conditions can escalate and then it is an emergency as well. So all of these things kind of add together to really put us in a situation where we really need to be sort of waving the flag about what this means for health as well. It's not just about the price point at the Bowser, it's about all of these things. And then it's about mental health and the fact that, you know, is it petrol or groceries? Do I go and see the doctor? Do I try and put bread on the table? That's kind of what we're looking at the moment. So it's really a public health crisis.
Absolutely it is. And I just want to pick up on a couple of points you made there about medicine supplies. So do you know much about how, you know, and if you don't, Kim, I'm sorry if I'm putting you on the spot, probably know more about it than I do. You know, like, are there any really concerning medicines where we're likely to run out of supply? Would that happen? And, you know.
Yeah, look, I can't comment too much on the actual logistics of pharmaceuticals. Just as an aside, and sort of Angie Bonhoino is on the call and I were talking about this yesterday, is the fact that I think a very significant percentage of our pharmaceuticals are petrochemical based. So let's just put that aside for a minute. We won't delve too deeply into that. But we're really thinking about anything, because if we're thinking about the supply chain and fuel shortages exposing the lack of resilience, you know, we have a very efficient health system in Australia, but it runs on kind of just-in-time supply chains and stable external conditions. And when we have something like this, there's very little buffer. So there's the risk that anything we can think of that requires transport, that requires anything that involves fossil fuels, like oil in this case, is at risk, essentially, as well. Yeah.
And you put that in with vulnerable populations, and a few of the points you touched on made me think about remote Aboriginal communities, particularly the dialysis patients up there, and what this must mean for their access to healthcare and their long-term outcomes. Yes, I mean, obviously we can only touch on it, but that's a massive problem. And I suppose that, turning to you now, Frances, the whole thing about energy supply and infrastructure and what you were referring to before, that where we are in the sort of the global diesel chain, what does this mean for you? What are you sort of how are you
Well, Rewiring Australia, we've always been a kind of solutions-focused organization. And Dr. Saul Griffith wrote The Big Switch, which really unpacked a story that that kind of stacks up the machines that are in our economy, and really, I think, points to the kind of obvious and basic fact that actually the solution for Australia to both emissions and especially to reducing dependence on oil is to think about how we actually cycle through the machines that rely on fossil fuels. So right now, the thing that's in the news is the fact that so many people want to go and fund an electric vehicle. And to be honest, it's actually an incredible moment, I think, that's gonna change things in a significant way. And I think we're going to talk about this turning point, hopefully in a positive sense, maybe in a decade from now, because I was in Canberra yesterday and this morning. I've just driven back this afternoon. I was attending a fuel conference about electric trucks, and it had been organized 12 months ago. But let me tell you, the companies that turned up to demonstrate the fact that they can already do freight management with electric trucks, there's never been a better timed conference at Parliament House, I think, in history. And it was really good to be able to have a lot of politicians see that the answers are already on the road and rolling around. The thing that I was talking with politicians about was about the EV salary packaging discount that's currently in place, but which has been tagged for a budget cut. And I think that the government is rethinking that really hard right now. And we were there to encourage them to keep pushing on that, because actually it's really important to identify ways that affect someone's decision making on the day when they're thinking about their next car, and to think really clearly about the fact that that's about the new car market. That if we can affect the share of EVs in the new car market and work that from the current 10%, it needs to get to 100%, and that needs to happen at some point as soon as possible. There's still a few models that aren't available, but there's a lot of electric SUVs, there's a lot of electric sedans, and the utes are starting to come into the market. So the opportunity's there, and we actually think there's a really strong case for the government to think a lot more about salary packaging some more, or looking to extend potentially like tax deductions to more people who might not get access to salary packaging through their workplace, so that similarly, like a wider range of people can look at that incentive when they're thinking about a new car and get that EV. And the benefit of that is not just that we take off, one machine that relies on imported petrol off the road, but at the same time, we add a battery on wheels that's doing a transport job 4% of the time. And if we plug it in, can play a really important role in the electricity grid the other 96% of the time when it's not driving around. And by the time we electrify all of the kinds of buses and trucks and cars that we have in Australia, we will have batteries in our vehicles that are 5 times the storage capacity of the Snowy Hydro system. And that will be an incredible component of our actual electricity network. So the transport system connects into the electricity system, and electricity is a thing that we can make in Australia. We can make it really easily. So there's not many countries that have kind of a clearer answer to the question, how would we not use oil anymore? Like in Australia, it's like we can make tons of electricity, and now there are electric vehicles that can run on it. So that's the good news, is that the answer is obvious, and the bad news is it'll take a really long time to do that. But there's 3,000 people that buy a car every day, so we can get started tomorrow.
And good on you, Francis, for going to finding the positive flip on this. And wouldn't it be lovely that like if there's an unintended consequence of this disaster in the Middle East, is that it is pushing the global transformation to get us off fossil fuels, which of course for anybody involved in the climate movement or anybody involved in health, is something that we've been looking for a long time. And it's probably not a way we could have predicted that we might kind of go down that road, but you know, if it gets us there, then you know, that's a bit of a plus.
Yeah.
And I like that idea about the electric vehicle fleet being able to kind of have a backup stability kind of factor in it. But I do want to turn to you now, Peter, and sort of talk about, you know, listening to what Francis was saying about electrification as a long-term answer and, you know, in a short-term and a long and medium-term answer. What are the things that you're thinking about with farming, and are there aspects of farming where the electrification thing's not going to come along quickly enough, or there's stumbling blocks, or, you know, I'm really interested in your opinion.
No, I think we need to move faster. I think that the urgency needs to be recognised, but then I've thought that for the last 20 years and it's, you know, people have been slow to move. And even with this crisis now, I think we need to be aware that there will be people suggesting that we take a direction of building more refineries and more storage and maybe drill the Great Australian Bite or whatever else they might come up with. Alternatively, we could take a different direction and say, right, the fossil fuel era is over and start doing things like Bowen's battery rollout. I mean, that came out 6 months ago, maybe 12 months ago. And the last time I looked, they had over 200,000 batteries installed. Well, imagine the sort of crisis we'd be having if we didn't have those 200,000 batteries installed. I think farmers are rapidly electrifying everything they can, their houses, their workshops, vehicles. There's issues with mobile machinery because it's a large thing, but, I mean, we're moving towards drones for spraying and various things. So I think that will be another movement. The one problem I do see is that you know, for sowing large areas, you require high horsepower tractors, and for harvesting them fast, you need, again, high horsepower tractors or headers. And I'd say we're 10 years away from working out whether we're going to convert to electricity or batteries or ammonia or hydrogen or some other source. But, you know, we've got a long way to go to get the big machinery off diesel. It may even be we might go to biofuels as a temporary solution or a permanent solution. I don't know, but we have to start seriously looking at that.
Yeah.
We import all our machinery from overseas pretty much, so we won't get a great deal of say in what direction it goes. The big, you know, Case New Hollands and International will decide what machines they're going to make, and we'll have to catch up. The real danger is if we don't pay attention and we're left holding the ball at the end of the day, like, if, you know, then we'll have a problem. As far as how I see, you know, I think the intersection of climate, nature repair, food supply and landscape repair all intersect in this sort of crisis at the moment, and we need to work on it. You know, we will come out the other side the same as we did with COVID. I mean, I accept the heat issues. I think one of the big ones is going to be the health of workers trying to work in hot conditions. But you know, we just can't keep taking short-term sort of answers when we need a long-term vision of how we're going to move forward.
No. Completely agree. Yeah, and obviously, you know, we're I suppose our vulnerability to our sort of infrastructure dependency on fossil fuels is really being highlighted with this, you know, awful event. And I feel like, you know, there are solutions there, and it's almost like, you know, so many of us have been trying to talk about these solutions for such a long time, and it's like, okay, now's the time, let's get on and do this. I am worried, however, though, about what the next few months, 6 months, year looks like for us in Australia. And, you know, when I'm hearing so many stories about, oh, we're not going to be able to put the crops in, We know that food prices are going up and stuff, and I really would like you to answer, Peter, on like, is there anything that you see that we could do in the short term that could protect us in the community from, you know, and if you know, it might, I know it might be a sort of a, you know, a trickier question, but what can we do? Is there anything we can do in the short term to protect ourselves from, you know, food insecurity and those sorts of things?
Well, you need, I think we need community resilience. I think we need to understand the problem. I mean, you know, we've kicked off an issue in Australia with fuel scarcity, but every week, you know, like I can remember back when Abbott was in government, we had 16 days supply in this country. And now we've got 30 days supply. There really isn't any need for this massive panic. Yes, we may run out of fuel in, you know, 2 or 3 months' time, and that might be something to worry about. But right now, I think if people could try and control their urge to protect themselves, which is, you know, it's a difficult urge. If you know, if the trucks stop, then supermarkets will run out of food in a week. And if you think you've got a problem now, wait till the community runs out of food, then you'll, you know. So we have to sort of get smart about saving where we can. Like, you know, I think we need to shorten up the food miles that we currently have. We need to regionally distribute lots of products so they're not just in time. Like we've all gone down this just in time road because it's a little bit cheaper. Now we're finding out the real cost of that decision. And so, yeah, like there's no simple answers. Like ever since, you know, I'd just like to say we've got an asset bubble in just about every class of asset in this country. And that has to burst. Like bubbles burst. I know that's painful when it happens, but it will happen, and people need to start thinking about that instead of just pretending that it'll all go on forever.
Isn't that the thing? You know, and I suppose we're, I'll just like what you said there about the need for us to kind of just keep a cool head, you know, that we're, you know, yes, it is scary. And of course, you know, the media likes to, you know, sensationalize things and that plays on people's fears. But, you know, we saw with COVID, you know, all the toilet paper wars and all of that sort of thing. If we start getting into that mentality, then we're going to be, you know, this sort of hoarding mentality. And then we start, you know, it's going to worsen societal divisions. And I think that's a big problem because, of course, some people really love to play on societal divisions. And that's not going to help us all get together. I wonder, Francis, in the last couple of days while you've been in Canberra with the big trucking electrification thing, did any of this stuff come up about what we're going to do in the short term? For, you know, distribution, or was it more of a longer term view?
Look, I would say that I was in conversations that were more about those long-term challenges. I think that I've been to Canberra quite a bit in the last couple of years, and I will say that there is like a seriousness around Parliament House that that I haven't kind of sensed before, that I think people are understand that this is like a pretty, that there's a lot of gravity to this national moment as well. And I guess that one thing that we could choose to do is that there could be actions that the government could ask people to take that are like kind of like if they enacted the fuel kind of rationing style approaches that are supposed to be like the next stage of fuel management in, you know, in favor of making sure that things like regional centers and farming can continue to make sure that they actually have fuel. I think there's an assumption that politicians don't want to rattle anyone and they don't want to step on anyone's lives, and we're all very independent. But I think we saw in COVID that actually there's a lot of willingness in Australia to act in the mutual interest and to think like a community and to think like a society. And if there's things that people in cities can do to help people in the regions continue to deliver food, and maybe we get public transport in the urban centres, and maybe farmers get discounted diesel. And it's like a moment when we can actually demonstrate that we do care about each other, which I think would be really valuable at a time when, like there's so much kind of like region versus city division in the politics that people are running at the moment. And yeah, it'd be nice if we could find ways to do that. I mean, I did see another chart that pointed out if you lower speed limits from 100 to down to 80, it actually cuts your fuel use by about 25% because your air resistance is a cubic law of how much energy it takes. So in the realm of Australian politics, cutting speed limits down is right up there on big ask for people, I suspect. But it's exactly that kind of thing that could make a difference.
And, you know, some pretty obvious health benefits there, really.
Driving slower, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And also, I think what you're kind of alluding to is the tapping into our care for each other in the community, you know, and that if we create, you know, maybe this is a time when, you know, we talked a little bit before about, you know, we're having this division in society. This could be a unifying time to say, all right, how am I going to help my neighbour? How are we going to work on this together? You know, carpooling or, you know, like I've got an EV, you know, I can, you know, help get my neighbour around, all those sorts of things. You know, and I think rural communities would do that very well. And I think if we, urban communities could be encouraged to do it in a, you know, a sense of cross-community altruism, there could be something, you know, really positive about that and perhaps, and caring. And, you know, obviously we know that, you know, the thing that makes people resilient during disasters is knowing your neighbour. So maybe this is a time for us to know our neighbours and work together, because if, you know, if there is no food on the supermarket shelf, then things can get hairy pretty quickly, and maybe this is a way of us getting through that. Perhaps we could all, you know, choose to practice that ourselves personally, everybody who's on the call tonight. Let's talk
maybe,
a bit
maybe the gas companies could tip in a little more tax revenue as well. That'd be cute.
Yes. Yeah, that would be a, you know, polluters pay thing. That's been a big thing that DEA and a few of us have talked about over the last week or so, and that beautiful chart of how much money we would have now. Let's turn to you, Kim, now. Let's talking a bit more about solutions. I think we've done a bit of, you know, defining the problem. You know, what would you like to see, Kim? How can we protect health in this time of oil instability?
Yeah, thanks, Kat, and appreciating that I'm kind of preaching to the converted here, and I'm loving just hearing Francis and Peter talk. So, but I do have a couple of things to say. I'm going to split this into kind of short-term resilience and long-term transition. So we're thinking about solutions in the short term. So we're in this now, this is happening. We need to see health explicitly treated as critical infrastructure in fuel planning, which is not the case everywhere. So there needs to be guaranteed fuel access for ambulances, community health, et cetera, primary care, with clear national triggers and transparent prioritisation, because this is a real problem and this is going to be a crisis for areas of our health system right now. We also need stronger local resilience. So things like backup power, electrified health transport, better integration across the board, so between hospitals, primary care and community, etc. Now, across Australia, we're moving towards these things, but this is a process. But all of these things will help in, you know, a future crisis like this. It's difficult for us to build up that resilience at this point. But I think some really interesting points have been raised, and it really had me thinking about things like local production. Now, of course, I'm not advocating for local fossil fuel production, don't get me wrong, but it just made me think about, you know, we have, with globalization, we've moved to just whatever, it doesn't need to be made here, it can be made over there, but we are living in such a volatile world now. This is not going to settle down. This is the world we live in now. And I think we saw this during COVID as well, that how quickly the world can narrow to our own backyard. But it's an opportunity as well, and we need to see it as an opportunity. So we did this during COVID, you know, we stood up mask manufacturing locally. We need to have a look at where we can invest, how we can turn this into an opportunity, how we can drive our economy as well in a really clean, green way that creates jobs for people too. I like to spruik South Australia. I know there's some SA people on the call. In 2006, SA was powered by 2% renewables. Next year, it will be nearly 100%. And that's whilst growing the South Australian economy as well. So it's not an either or, but we need to be thinking about this moment and how we can catalyse change. In the longer term, of course, the real solution for protecting health and security is reducing our dependence on fossil fuels altogether. Fossil fuel systems are inherently vulnerable to many things. So supply shocks, price shocks, geopolitical instability, which we're seeing at the moment, those vulnerabilities also translate directly into health risks as well. And I think it's really important too, we're used to in health kind of talking about this in a health way, but reframing this in an appreciation that this is not just a climate strategy, it's a health and economic strategy as well. We know clean energy reduces all kinds of different health impacts, but also dramatically lowers health costs as well. And we know that globally, if we look at health savings, the transition largely pays for itself. So air pollution from fossil fuels, for example, about 5 million premature deaths globally each year. Those health costs alone exceed the cost of transitioning to clean energy across the world. So it's a very, very powerful argument as well. We know that global health costs are about $1.1 trillion a year. In major economies, air pollution, climate-related health harms, about 5% of the GDP, which exceeds national health budgets. And then if we bring fossil fuel subsidies into it, that's up to about $1.6 trillion a year, which dwarfs any global health adaptation funding, which means all of our communities are paying twice, once through subsidies and another time through healthcare as well. So when we talk about the cost of transition, we don't talk enough about that enormous health bill that fossil fuels are already imposing on households, our communities, our hospitals, our governments. We really need to use this as a moment to say, this is such a good argument that we need to move away from fossil fuels, but then we would not be in the mess we're in at the moment.
If you'd like to hear the rest of the webinar, you can go to YouTube and go to Doctors for the Environment Australia and go to the video Quitting Our Oil Dependency, Protecting Our Communities from Global Oil Volatility for Our Health. You can also learn more about Doctors for the Environment Australia through their website, which is dea.org.au, where you can also find an open letter to Australian governments urging them to break out of our dependency on global oil and choose a healthier future. You've been listening to the Climate Action Show on the Community Broadcast Network, or more specifically 3CR 855 AM. Thank you so much for tuning in tonight. I've been your host, Bella. Once again, thank you to Antimony, one of our Climate Action Show members, and the local activists outside of MP Sarah Whitty's office too, who are willing to give us a chat about their protesting against Labor's potential coal and gas expansions. Once again, if you're interested in getting involved, they'll be there every Friday, 12:30 to 1:30 p.m, and they love to have a coffee and a chat to discuss what they're all about and why they're there. And once again, thank you to the Doctors for the Environment Australia for allowing us to air the After Hours webinar, Quitting Our Oil Dependency. If you wanted to go back and have a listen, you can go to our page, The Climate Action Show, at 3cr.org.au, where a playback version of this episode will be available. We'll be back next week, 5 p.m. Monday. Stay tuned for Breadline on Next.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared. It's coal. It's coal.
Tune in every Monday at 5 p.m. to hear the Climate Action Radio Show.